And he said everything that you put in the press conference about Damari was exactly what he said to me at Swansea. He's like, you got a nice car, too young. You got X amount of like wages, like you're getting paid, blah, blah, blah. So he said exactly the same thing. And then, so I think from that point, I was really struggling then to get him back on my side. But going back to the conspiracy stuff, I think it must be about 67 conspiracies that are right compared to the other ones, like the chemtrails that in the actual UK government website are being, you know, they're in there. But he was like bringing in players, backhanders going on left, right and center of like the players he looked after, and they were no good. You know, I remember when Harry Redknapp was here, we're doing shape on the side of the pitch, he's gone from wanting to find me 2 weeks wages to then liking me because I come back into train. I was made to train on my own, running around the pitch. And I just thought, well, after me being one of the main players for a couple of seasons, doing well, I was negotiating the new deal with Rowett as well, because I wanted to finish my career really at Birmingham.
Yeah.
So I loved it here. And then I was then made to train on my own. He was training now and again. He had his own, like, you know, fitness coach and Spanish like guy who came over from Real Madrid to make sure
he carries clubs from on the golf course.
But he was he was training in and out. He was like obviously all patched up for games and stuff, but he was still, you know, well, he's unreal. I think that's what worked well, because I think the first game was Watford, I think, when he took over, I'm not sure. And then Clayton scored and we won 1-0, which obviously is a great start, and we kicked on. I truly still believe to this day, if he would have been kept on and we signed a couple of players in that January, we would have been promoted.
Before we get into this, we're doing over 1 million engagements a month, but most of you aren't subscribed. If you enjoy the content, hit subscribe and follow us on socials. It'll make such a massive difference. Cheers.
Thanks for coming. Yeah.
No worries.
How's the journey?
All right. It was good. No, it's fine. Used to it.
Brill. We're not formal. We don't do massive introductions, but if you can just tell us a little bit about yourself and your playing career, just to kind of introduce, and then we'll delve deeper into it.
Yeah, David Cottrell, used to play on the wing. I had a decent career, not too bad at all. Made my debut at Bristol City when I was 16, and then managed to make my debut for Wales when I was 17. So yeah, I played international football, played in the Prem for a little bit, and then majority, I'd say, probably the Championship.
Class. So we've got the stats here. Over 650 professional appearances, 24 caps for Wales.
Yeah.
Sound about right?
Yeah.
When you look back, what are your proudest moments?
Probably my debut initially, because every boy sets out to be a footballer. So I managed to do that with Bristol City, which were an amazing club and amazing academy. And that was great. But then I think probably making my debut for Wales would be up number one, I'd say. Mm-hmm. I always want to play for Wales.
Who's he against? Who's he play against?
That's a good question. I should know this, shouldn't I? I don't even know. I think it was Azerbaijan, actually. Yeah, Azerbaijan in the Millennium. It used to be the old Millennium Stadium, and now the Prince of Palit Stadium.
Yeah,
but it was quite strange making my debut then, because it wasn't a full house. We would go through a real bad phase of Welsh football at that particular time, and it was like a 60,000-70,000 stadium. I think we may be lucky to get 10,000-15,000 fans to watch those games back in the day. Yeah,
I can't imagine what that was like with cricket in there, because we were in there for obviously the Worthington Cup final.
Yeah,
at its peak with the roof over.
Yeah. It's a key old place, isn't it?
It was like playing, the only thing I could describe, like the old reserve games where you've got like a few fans just lingering around and watching a couple of them. That's what it felt like. Yeah.
Because at the time, yeah, like you say, at the time, there's over the last maybe 20 years, Welsh football has gone from strength to strength, hasn't it? But I remember a time it was like in the doldrums, wasn't it?
Yeah.
It was like out of the England, Ireland, Scotland, Wales. Wales were probably the minnows, really, weren't they?
Yeah, we were. Yeah, something probably, as you say, the last, I would say, since 2016, well, maybe a few years prior to that, when Gary Speed took over, things started to get professional. And then obviously Chris Coleman came in and we managed to qualify for the Euros. I think the first tournament we qualified was huge then, to kind of like transcend or take Welsh football forward, because it gives you a pot of money to invest in the younger, you know, people coming through, really, to give them a better training, better facilities, which obviously, you know, gives that a little bit more, you know, stability. Really.
Game changer.
Yeah.
Mm. So we've got an interesting stat. Tell me if it's correct or not. Obviously, when you're at Blues, everyone's aware of the financial difficulties we had, but is it right that from the journey to the Euro 2016 with Wales, that Blues got a windfall of $350,000 for you club compensation scheme?
Did they? I'm not sure.
Yeah, so I
don't know, you know more
they're
about that,
like,
than me. Yeah, yeah,
yeah. Come on, Dave.
Well, apparently so, because yeah, I'd heard about those, but is that not something that you as a player?
No, we're not made aware of those. The only thing that I was aware of is when actually, when I got married, I was reporting back late for training, and Gary Rout was the manager when we agreed for me to go on my honeymoon and come back later, because when you're on international duty, etc., you get given a little bit more time off. And then Gianfranco Zola was made aware, and then we obviously managers were getting changed left, right, and centre. And Harry Redknapp came in and didn't know what was going on. They tried finding me 2 weeks' wages, and I was just like, "Nah, it's already been put in place." So,
oh, so the thing you agreed with,
yeah, they wanted the conversation on my 2 weeks' wages.
He was like, "No, this is not happening." It was probably the spice of your wedding and your honeymoon.
It wasn't a very good time.
So, how did the club? We know from when you joined Blues. So you've been at Doncaster, haven't you?
Yeah.
Was there ever a plan to stay there? Because it was just a one. Was it a 1 year deal that you'd gone on?
Yeah, I went there for like a year contract. I think I went initially, and then my plan was I left Swansea, and I was not really enjoying football at that particular time. I was being made to train on my own by Brendan Rodgers. I was like, you know, I was training with like a couple of the youth players when the first team players were coming in. I was in the squad, and I missed two penalties back to back. I never seen the pitch again. So I was then made to train with like the youngsters, which that was quite difficult mentally, because, you know, you're in the first team, you're in around, the boys are going off, they were flying, they're looking to get, they got promoted that year as well. I wasn't enjoying football, it was tough. And then being made to train with like the youngsters or sometimes on your own, it's not great. Mm. I know some fans or anyone who's listened to this might think, well, if I was getting paid X amount of money, I don't care what they'll do. But when you're in that position,
yeah,
all you want to do is play football. So when that's taken away from you, you don't really think about the, you know, that side of things.
That's the default, isn't it, for some fans sometimes? Yeah. Oh, I don't know why he's talking about mental health, or he's talking about this, that, and the other. He's getting still paid.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
Like you say, it's about your life and what you're doing day to day, isn't it? That's big.
What was the fallout with that then? That system that he played, I thought you would fit quite well.
Yeah.
That was proper 4-3-3, wasn't it?
Yeah, we had, I was playing in the number 10 role behind Nathan Dyer and Scott Sinclair at the time. We were struggling for a main focal point of the striker, but everything else was, you know, had a really good team. And yeah, I was playing quite well. I was chipping in with a few goals. I was on penalties, as I said, and I missed two penalties on the bounce. And then that was it then. It was just kind of like, well,
harsh.
Yeah, but it happens. I don't think he, I remember him saying a comment about Damari Gray when he was at Leicester. And he said exactly the same comment to me when he's at Swansea. He's, you know, you've had things too young and blah, blah, blah. But if you're a youngster coming through and you're doing well, if you're getting offered a contract, you're not going to say, oh, by the way, can you keep it away from me? Because it's not the right time for me, you know. And he said, everything that you put in the press conference about Damari was exactly what he said to me at Swansea. He's like, you got a nice car, too young. You got X amount of like wages, like you're getting paid, blah, blah, blah. So he said exactly the same thing. And then, so I think from that point, I was really struggling then to get him back on my side.
What ironic, considering the way he moved in his career then, isn't it, as a manager?
Yeah. I've not got anything bad to say about him. His training is probably the best training I've ever had. Is just always like really, you know, different sessions every day. The intensity was great. But I think he probably thought himself as a bit chocolate. You know, he thought he might be better than us and whatever else. But he did extremely well. He's obviously gone on to do, you know, great things as well. It's just obviously football's all about opinions.
Yeah, exactly. Just take it back slightly then. How did you get into football?
So I started playing football when I was probably about 5 or 6. I always had a ball at my feet. My brother was playing football with his mates and, you know, older mates. But my dad ultimately was the one who got me into. He's a big Man United fan. And then, yeah, just kicking a ball in the street like we all used to back in the day. Not like, well, you know, it's changed now, isn't it? Or on, you know, video games and whatever else. But I always had a ball at my feet from a young age. And then I got into my first team when I was 6. Luckily in Cardiff, I couldn't get into a team because it was too young. They started like 7 or 8. So I had to go to Barry, where obviously Gavin and Stacey's filmed there. So I went to a team there, and then I got managed to pick up by Bristol City when I was 10. But it was quite strange. The game I got picked up in was a game when I didn't score. I was a striker. I was always really quick and could obviously hit a ball. And I scored ridiculous amounts of goals. But the first game I didn't score a goal, I got, you know, scouted for Bristol City. Strange.
So, I was going to say, were you always a winger? Because we're talking before, weren't we? Like watching your highlight reel, the way you strike a ball so cleanly. I don't think there's anyone kind of since that hits the ball the way you did. So what was that? How did you, was it natural talent or was it coaching? How How did you become such so attacking minded? How did you find where the net was so easily?
I think I was always practicing in the street. I was always like looking for the small gates in people's doorways just to try and like whip them in. And I was always playing against older boys back in the day, and they would obviously toughen you up. They'd smash you. They wouldn't care. And I think that kind of helps, you know. I think, and then when I got picked up at Bristol City, the academy was great. They were always practicing on different drills, always the ball at the feet, which is probably what they train like now. But I think they were maybe a bit ahead of their time back then. They always wanted the ball at the feet, and I think that helped with the coaching. But I could always strike a good ball. Yeah, I think there's a bit of natural ability, and then, you know, I'd worked on it as well. But with free kicks and corners, I was always practicing, you know, after training each day just to make sure I was getting, you know, better and being more precise with the delivery, really.
Mm-hmm. It showed, yeah.
Which see, time, weren't we, from down here, from your time when you were here? See, there was Clates, weren't there? And then Duke.
Yeah.
So you must have been an absolute dream for them boys to know, because it's the game now, in my opinion, for the worse has changed, hasn't it? That everything now is inverted. Everything's very narrow, inside forward rather than wingers. Yeah. So the delivery of the ball seems to have gone out of the game, really.
I find football boring to watch these days, especially the Premier League stuff. I think everyone's quite robotic. And there's a lot of people who've, you know, have not really played the game. And because they've done the coaching badges or whatever else, and I'm not saying it's not a bad thing. I'm thinking, you know, like it could be a good blend. Just because you haven't played the game doesn't mean you can't then coach, because you can. Obviously, there's good coaches out there who's made it. But I just think everything's always about the data and about this and about that now. And they're all looking at the managers, what they're saying and what they're not saying. And it's just so regimental and boring. It's just all the same thing. Like not, very few wingers now are going past a defender, you know, like off the cuff, whipping in across. As I say, it's like the other day, I seen Cherky was getting abused because he's doing kick-ups. And I think that's like entertaining. That's like bringing like fans on side, and he's doing something different that no one else is doing at the moment. Yeah. Whereas I do think football back in, you know, a few years back, I probably sound like a dinosaur, but I think it was a lot better and more entertaining to watch.
It feels like they've complicated it too much, where it's just like a ball, put it in the net, score more, and get away with ways of doing that. I mean, sometimes it's come from Pep, hasn't it, who's arguably the greatest manager in the world, that anything that he does is then kind of brought down, even to the leagues where you haven't got the kind of players that can do that, especially from the back and playing out and stuff. And as a fan, we're paying for entertainment. And,
yes.
And I don't know, possession football serves a purpose sometimes, obviously.
Yeah.
But we want to be seeing a bit more kind of, the saying, the long balls kind of coming back in, and it's popular and someone's reinvented the long ball, but that's the kind of football we like, where it's attacking events. And yeah, again, I sound like a dinosaur, but we seem to be losing that a little bit.
Yeah, that's, I think, what happened with Blues when I was there. You know, we had Rowett, who we had like exciting wingers, and obviously Clates up front, and we brought in Juki, and obviously good strikers. Clates was very quick, very powerful. And then you had obviously me or Damari or, you know, Magoma on the wings, and we had like a number 10. We had good number 10s. We had a good team.
Yeah.
And then when you want to try and bring in total football, when you don't have the players that are used to playing that, there's a, you know, things can't happen overnight. It takes time. And yeah, I think that's what the issue was as well.
Yeah. So the season you had at Doncaster, so you knew, as that's coming to a close, when were you made aware of, or was the interest from Blues after that finished? Because I know at the time we had a transfer embargo, didn't we? So you being a free.
It's quite strange. I was always linked with Birmingham as a kid as well. When I was in Bristol City's academy coming through, I was always like, oh, the first team, I always like had that kind of like links. And I thought, from a, you know, perspective of like Birmingham's not so far from Cardiff kind of thing as well, that could be quite well. And I always seen Birmingham as a big club and things like that. I went to Doncaster just to find my love for the game. Dean Saunders was the manager. He was the Welsh coach as well. And I knew I would have, you know, a little bit of loving probably that I needed at that time to start enjoying football again. And we wanted to get promoted. We went there, and I probably used it. They used me just as probably as much as used them, just as like a stepping stone, really. Yeah. I just wanted to go back to them, you know, go forward. And ultimately, they gave me an amazing season where, you know, we got promoted on the last day of the season. I don't know if you remember that. And when Brentford hit the crossbar, and we're going to go from first to third if we lost in the playoffs, and we end up, obviously, Coppinger scored and we were champions. But we had an amazing group of lads there. Everyone was like really together. And then, as soon as the interest came in from Blues, you know, I wanted to go to kind of like further myself to cement my place in the Welsh squad more than anything, because obviously Birmingham was a bigger club in the champ, and it was just the best move for me.
Yeah. What was your first conversation like with Saunders?
Yeah, he was, well, he actually left. He left, he went to manage Wolves and then got sacked. He was trying to get me to go to Wolves. So he says, you never know why. You never know if he's fucking telling the truth or not. So yeah, he went to Wolves, and then we had someone else take over, just, you know, Dickoff come in. He's a good guy, and it just didn't work out for him in the end. But yeah, ultimately I wanted to get closer to Cardiff as well for my children. So it made sense for me to come to Birmingham.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a good old commute, that, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. What were your first impressions when you got here?
Yeah, I loved it from the time I got here. Quickly realised it was obviously a lot bigger club than Doncaster, of course. And yeah, it was great. I think, you know, Lee Clark was trying to bring in a few fresh faces, because I think he was struggling at the time of trying to get, you know, a few of the older players out and so on. So it was kind of like a little transition period. But yeah, he was great. I wouldn't have been here unless he brought me in here. And yeah, it was good. I liked it from the start we got on here. I think everyone's got their different views on Clarkie, but he was great for me.
Oh, Paul Robinson said the same, didn't he?
We've heard good things about Clarkie.
He was great for us, you know, like his old school mentality. He had a good playing career football wise, and yeah, he wanted things very simple. He would take, you know, pressure off us as well. And if someone needed to kick up the arse, we're here to win, not to, you know, just take part.
Yeah. Well, Paul was saying, well, I need the different pressures, because he's from managing himself. He was saying, looking back, the amount of weight that Clark was carrying, the whole club away from football as well. So to still be able to come out with a smile on your face and try and kind of G the lads up, it was no small thing, was it?
Yeah.
What were your experiences or knowledge of what was going on behind the scenes there at that time?
I didn't really know too much, to be honest. I think there was like some of the boys who were still left from the Prem days were still on big wages, and they were trying to ship them out. And it's not an easy task, because if you're on certain wages and you're sitting here, you're not gonna leave. Because they might not get those wages elsewhere. So you can understand the player's perspective, because it's a short career. But from Lee Clark's point of view, he's trying to build the club up. And he gave Damari his debut, where, you know, he's done a lot of good things as well. I know he was getting stick from the fans, which you're probably going to if you're not finishing, you know, in certain places in the division when you're deemed as like a big club. It's not going to go down well. But I thought he was good. He tried bringing everyone back together, and unfortunately went on like a run of bad results, and then, you know, he left. But yeah, I didn't have no problem with him. I thought he was good for me, because he brought me here, and then good for the boys as well.
So obviously then, from fans, and we got limited information about the position the club was in with the owners and stuff. Was you aware of that day to day? Did it affect your train, your headspace? Did you see it affecting Lee Clark, or was it kind of just hunched together and it's us against them kind of mentality? I don't know.
Yeah, we don't really get involved in like the owner side of things. Ultimately, it's down to us to deliver on the pitch, and that's it. We didn't really pay attention if Lee Clark might be in the boardrooms having these meetings. Of course he would, but I'm not sure how much he had a say on all that kind of stuff. His job is to manage the players he's got in front of him on the training pitch, and we wouldn't get involved in that. We just wanted to do what's best for the club and ourselves to, you know, perform and get the 3 points. That was our main objective, obviously, every game.
Yeah. How long was he here once he signed you? He wasn't here long.
He wasn't here long, no. Okay. He, maybe a few months.
I see a brief intake of breath, because you know we're going on to managers.
Yeah, you're like, I know.
Like, trying to jog the memory.
I know, it's like, fucking hell. But it's difficult for a manager, because you can never please everyone. And again, it's about opinion. Some of the players might like the manager, some of them not. That's just the way it is. But of course, if you're playing, you're going to like him a bit more, and you tolerate him a bit better. Yeah. When you're not playing, you know they're shit. That's when you've got an issue.
Yeah.
So we're saying, so he's out the door then. Gary comes in.
Yeah.
So again, yeah, highly, highly thought of, still not accounting for, obviously, the relegation. He stepped in. That's a different thing. His first tenure here. So he was held in very high regard still from fans.
Yeah.
So what's the kind of change of style and everything else then from Lee Clark to Gary Rabbit?
I think we were just more organised in terms of the defensive unit. I think you might have changed like a bit of personnel as well. Like some of the boys who are not in the squad or in the team, you bring a couple in, this like freshens it up a bit and give them a second chance. But I think he was just like really, you know, regimental on the terms of like, he's very organized, knew exactly what we wanted as a team. And also we were not playing so open. I think we maybe had the arrogance before that we could just outplay other teams, and we weren't probably good enough to do that. We were hitting people under counter-attack when Raut was here. Even at home games, we'd still not have that ego just to like sit back and then we'll break people down. I think that's what worked well, because I think the first game was Watford, I think, when he took over. I'm not sure. And then Clayton scored and we won 1-0, which obviously is a great start, and we kicked on. I truly still believe to this day, if he would have been kept on and we signed a couple of players in that January, we would have been promoted. But the owners had different...
Don't say that.
No, but yeah. But with that, did we have the resources to sign anyone that January?
Well, we were struggling. We were on about bringing, obviously, a couple of players in permanently, especially. We were always looking for that number 10, and we had a couple of decent ones, like, you know, John Terrell, and I don't think we could afford him at the time or whatever was going on. But he would have been perfect, and obviously we brought in Diego later on, a later date. But I thought John...
That never worked out, either, did he?
No, it didn't work out the second time, yeah. Sometimes that happens, you know, but then I think Terrell was the missing part to the jigsaw of that. If we could have got him over the line, I think it would have been good for us.
A few people have said that. Fitness has been mentioned as well, that Raut was mad on fitness and getting Ryan, because I think I remember with Lee Clark and stuff, we'd tail off a little bit towards the ending games, whereas Raut then got the players like super fit.
It was at the end of games then where we tended to snatch the wins, wasn't it? On 2/3 of the game, like you say, we'd sit and we'd be tentative and counter, and then...
Yeah, we were always really fit. We were always like doing lots of like running, like the training was like intense. And even before games, you know, it was on the button, which I think it has to be. If you're at like elite kind of like levels in terms of any sport, you need to be on it. And I think we always felt like we would run over teams as well. Our fitness would play a huge part later on in games. And we just, you know, if we stayed in the game, we'd always nick a goal. Clates would nick a goal. Damari could do anything at any given time. Obviously, Jack McGowan was good, you know, good player. He could do something or like a set piece. So, yeah, we had like a lot of good things that were going on. I think we were a couple of signings just short of doing something special.
Yeah.
So from kind of emotion in football up and down, Doncaster, you're part of the promoted team.
Yeah.
Blues, you're part of the Great Escape.
Yeah.
What was that like to be around going down to Lost?
I was still at Doncaster when you guys stayed up. I think I was leaving Doncaster. I'm not sure if they got relegated and I come and signed here, I believe. Oh, yeah, really? Yeah, I won at Birmingham because Caddy scored.
Yeah, yeah, yeah,
yeah. Yeah. So I joined that summer after that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So joining then as well.
Yeah.
You talk about characters. Caddis was a character down there. Who was you kind of straight in? Did you know a few of them from before?
I knew Neil Eardley because he was obviously in the Welsh squad.
Yeah.
I just knew a few of the boys from just playing against them, obviously, you know, competing against each other every other week or wherever it might have been.
Yeah. You've scored some goals against us.
Yeah, I scored a couple against. Scored a screamer for Doncaster here, actually. But yeah, I probably, when I first signed, I got on well straight away with Clades. I think because we were both new signers at the same time, Mark Duffy as well, and Darren Randolph, I think, we were like pretty close. And we had a good group of boys as well. They were like, well, Michael Morrison was my roommate eventually, and then obviously got on really well with Paul Robinson. But we had like an old school kind of group still, where we'd like the drinking culture was still there, where we'd go out like once a week on a Tuesday or a Wednesday. And yeah, that was still kind of there, but it filtered out towards the end.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's great nucleus of characters there. Yeah. You talk about characters in football and what you need to survive. There's a bit of steel in the team.
Yeah.
There's a lot of characters there that can, including yourself, just grab it by the scruff of the neck and say, come on, let's do it kind of thing.
We had a good dressing room, to be fair. We didn't have like no idiots about. It was just like everyone wanted to work hard, do what's best as a club. And I think that's what really, we were a close group.
Yeah. It's missing this day and age as well, particularly down here sometimes. But it seems to have been lost a little bit in translation, that the kind of grit and... And how much you're allowed to do it on the pitch now is another thing. But
yeah,
when we're talking to Robbo and stuff, like a tackle going in, that's it. Then you're all up and it's like a goal. I know, we said that. Yeah, we said
15 bookings that season, wasn't it? But so when you're playing, a lot of your goals, I think all your goals were from 25 yards out plus. Is that something you're doing in training? Or is that something you're like, I'm just going to go for it? Because now it looks as though no one really shoots. It's lost art in football, isn't it? Yeah. 25 yard screamers.
Everyone sort of wants that perfect goal, don't they? The cut back or wherever, like the
try
back and the lap in kind of, yeah. I think Yeah, I was always just used to have a hit. You know, my dad always used to say, for sin, like, you know, in distance, have a go. And I was always just like, yeah, just have a go for it and just go for it, you know.
You had like a little neck knuckleball technique as well.
Yeah, I used to practice that, yeah. I used to have, well, me and Bale, when we were in the Welsh squad, we'd always practice hitting the valve and get a knuckleball going on. But I could always like strike a good ball, which was obviously helps, doesn't it? If you have like a shot from distance, someone
by even if the keeper spills it, then you're leaving it on for someone, aren't you? Yeah. But the keeper never spilt yours, never got near him, did they? Yeah, most of them were.
There was one where I seen it, and the keeper's like over the other side of the goal, thinking, like, where's it?
Yeah,
you've done something with it.
It's a one free kick, you hit, but you put it at the post that he's on, didn't you?
Yeah,
and just put him on his arse. You just
I think that was Huddersfield, I think it was away, yeah. And we were, you know, funny enough, we were losing, I think, 1-0. And we had to get a minimum of a point, otherwise Gary Rowe was going to give us a day off. So when I scored late, the boys were like, yeah, we know we can.
We're not the hero.
Days off for a few beers.
And who was it? Was it Fulham? Who was the free kick, pretty much cornerish?
Yeah, Fulham. Yeah,
Fulham.
Yeah, yeah. And just went far post.
Was that a cross?
Yeah, it was a cross, yeah. I was like, yeah, I was aiming for the far post. I always
But you get them on top,
yeah. If you take a free kick, if you aim for the far post and everyone misses it, it's going to go in. Or you get a slight glance and then they get a goal. That was always what I practiced. That was always what I was told, you know, if you're taking a free kick, aim for the far post and with a bit of pace on.
Yeah.
You missed your place in this Arsenal team now, didn't you?
I know.
And now I've got a set piece coach to teach them that.
That's crazy, isn't it?
They all go and celebrate with the set piece coach because you put the ball to the back post.
Yeah.
It's mind boggling.
It's not rocket science.
Yeah,
it?
Exactly. Yeah.
Not, do you look at football and see that now and how kind of it's gone round in a circle and set pieces, long throw-ins?
The one I can't get over is from when you take the kickoff and they're now hitting it like a rugby kind of like tactic with
doing that.
Yeah, just to give them the, you know, it's like they're taking the throw and then you go win possession, then you're obviously on the attack. I can understand that part of like being on attack, but I've
gone for it.
There's too many cooks in the kitchen.
There's
too many cooks in the kitchen where it's like just, you know, well, we want to be different or we want to do this and want to do that. Whereas, as what you said before, like Pep has brought in such a, you know,
Philosophy,
yeah. Everyone thinks they can do it.
Single-handedly destroyed English football.
Yeah, well,
in the best way.
Yeah, it's crazy, isn't it? Because he's obviously amazing what he does, and it's not his, because he's a genius. Everyone's tried to follow what he's doing, but ultimately, some of the players at the lower divisions, they can't do what, you know.
You're asking centre-halves to play out from goal kicks and stuff, and they're just headers and hoofers.
Like, old school football's gone a little bit, hasn't it?
Yeah.
When you were little, the golden rule wasn't it? Do not play the ball across your own box. Whatever happens.
Yeah.
Now it's actively encouraged.
But the academies, that's what they're teaching, isn't it? And even if you get the ball taken off you and concede, we do it again. Don't worry if you concede.
But then he dupes everyone then by signing Haaland and bringing number nines back, and all of a sudden everyone's like, where's that number nine we had? Oh no, he's turned
never replace Aguero.
He's turned into an eight now or an 11, and we've turned him into this a three with the Spain not playing a striker. Oh no, we need some number nines, and that's why now I think England suffer a lot with it, don't they, in the national side, because bar Kane, in my opinion, there's not someone who can go into that.
Yeah,
as a out and out number nine.
No, Kane's a freak though. No, he's class. He's top level.
Man,
he's an unbelievable player.
The age is that to move abroad and become a better player.
Yeah, he's class.
It's nice he was able to win some trophies as well.
I know. Yeah, because that would have dampened him, wouldn't it?
Oh but... God, yeah, yeah.
But so international football.
Yep.
Tenuous link. So tell us about that run. You scored against Cyprus in the qualifiers, didn't you?
Yeah.
Euro 2016.
Yeah, we were. To be fair, I was out of the squad for a little while because obviously I wasn't playing at Swansea, and I went to Doncaster, I managed to get back in the squad. And even like a couple of my teammates were like, you've done well getting back in the squad, because some players who go missing for a year or two, they don't ever get back in. So I had to knuckle down. I knew I was always good enough to be in the squad. I had 24 caps. I probably should have had about 80 to 100, I would have thought. I made my debut when I was 17. But I had like Bale, Giggs and Bellamy. And I was always seen as like maybe a striker in that sense as well. So, and then Ramsey, obviously the formation we used to play with a box midfield, you know, Chris Coleman would say, look at the position that Bale and Ramsey are in. I'm like, I'm definitely not getting the game, because obviously there's levels to the game. There's levels to the game. But
hoping for a nigger in training.
Some of the other boys, I thought I, when Toshak was manager and so on, I thought I should have had a lot more caps. The amount of trips I used to go on and wouldn't get on, and it was quite bizarre because you always wanted players to be playing at a higher level. And at the time I was in the Prem, and you get players in like League Two, or sometimes maybe even in the Welsh Premier League, who would come in and they're, you're just like, what's going on here? So I should have had definitely, you know, a lot more caps.
Did you have a conversation with the manager at that point?
There's no having a conversation with Toshak. I'm grateful he gave him my debut, but his ego definitely wouldn't allow that at that time. And to be fair, he gave a lot of the journey probably started with him, because he said, look, you know, we need to give all these youngsters a chance to get all these caps, build up their, you know, kind of like international football experience that they need. And he's the one who started it off. We were not professional at all, though. Like, we were going away, we having like fucking Chinese food and Indian food, and Bellamy and Giggs were just like, what's going on here? It's the same way Roy Keane probably talks about Ireland is what those who used to think about Welsh football, you know. And Toshak used to say, well, no one wants to be here, just make him happy. He used to take us to like San Sebastian to be red wine all on the table, and fucking supposed to be training the next day and playing that. Yeah, so
wow.
Yeah. So it used to be a bit of a shit show. And then as soon as Speedo come in, it got really professional. And because obviously he's probably him and Bellamy, I'd say, are the best professionals I've ever played with. And he was just like on it all the time. So he brought that professional element into it. And then things started to progress with Wales, you know, slowly but surely.
Yeah, I was going to say, at that point, because is it easy to play for coaches that in your lifetime have been a great footballer that you've seen? Because obviously Gary Speed was class, wasn't he? Mm. Is it easier to be coached by someone that you've seen, that you know they've got they can back it up, rather than managers that come in, you don't know anything about them?
Yeah, you say that. We had obviously Zola here, and sometimes I laughed at one training session with Zola, and like with Speedo, he's my teammate at Chef U, so he was amazing to me. He was class. We used to travel together from Manchester over to Sheffield, and we had like a car school. So I've always had that respect for him. And then when he was coaching, everything he was saying was, you know, said for the best of the team, really. But when we had Zola here, you know, going off that, he's obviously one of the best players playing in the Premier League history, but he was asking players to do stuff that they couldn't do. You know, I remember we were doing a training session. He pinged a ball out to me and I crossed it for Isaac Purcell when he was here.
Yeah.
And I crossed it, it's hit his shin, and it's gone wide, and Zola's gone mad. He's like, what is this? What is this? And so he's done the same thing. I'd cross this, not even a good cross, it's outside the box, and he's volleyed it to top corner, and he's like, well, this is what.
Done what one of them ones on the front
and
post.
I started laughing. He pulled me off the train. He's like, why are you laughing at? I said, like, you're one of the best players who plays in the Prem, basically, and you're asking players to do stuff that they can't do. Like, what are you supposed to do with that? There's levels. And then we just... I think his coach as well was useless. Fuck me. One of the worst coaches I've ever come across in my life. He was just literally...
Was that what's his name?
A big, tall Italian guy.
I think Digger mentioned
him. Yeah, is it Gabriel or something?
Was it Gabriel?
Yeah, Digger said, I don't know if you were privy to this, but Digger said Zola would take your training and do your shape and stuff.
Oh, yeah.
And then the coach...
The guy that pulled you in the hotel
The coach would be
room.
Like, come up to the hotel room. He'd be like, don't do any of that. And everyone's... I think it was more the central midfielders, him, Gleese, and they go, don't do that, do this. So they're doing shape and everything on the training field, knees taking them up and going, nah,
yes,
do this. Before the game, saying and all that.
Yeah, it's crazy. Well, he used to want us to, we'd just do an intense training session for hours, because like the Italian way is that you train a lot longer. We went from doing training with like high intensity with routes, then standing out there for hours nonstop. And then when you're drinking and your water, he wants you to jog on the spot while you're on your water. And so little things like that, and I'd be like, fuck off, I want a drink of water. I'll stand still, I don't need to like be jogging on the spot. And I never heard of him anyway. Yeah, it's a bit strange. So it was just a lot of there's a lot of things going on that were just irritating the players. Mm. And then we just went, as I say, we went from literally playing counter-attacking football, being really organized, to literally shit show, being free and asking players to do stuff that they can't do.
Yeah, I was going to say, because that was a complete change of system as well. What were you being asked to do in that system then?
Well, originally I was in the team, and then I got taken out, and then you're bringing in players who were, in my opinion, wasn't better than what we had. But there was backhanders fucking going left, right and center, you know, with I can't remember the agent's name. They got his dad used to own Arsenal.
Not David Deanson, was it?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So he was like bringing in players, backhanders going on left, right, and centre of like the players he looked after, and they were no good. You know, I remember when Harry Redknapp was here, we're doing shape on the side of the pitch, he's gone from wanting to find me 2 weeks' wages to then liking me because I come back into training. I was made to train on my own, running around the pitch. And I just thought, well, after me being one of the main players for a couple of seasons, doing well, I was negotiating the new deal with Rowett as well because I wanted to finish my career really at Birmingham.
Yeah.
So I loved it here. And then I was then made to train on my own. And then you come in, you're like expecting to hit the ground running of like first team football. It's hard when you've been out for a little while. It's hard to then get going. But he signed a midfield player. And he was like saying, oh, what do you think of him there? And like we were doing shape with no pressure on the ball. I said, well, I cracked the joke. I said, my mum could fucking play in the midfield because no pressure on the ball. He said, oh, well, I've given him 40 grand a week and I've signed the wrong player.
Oh, yeah.
Awful. And he was a nice guy. And I don't want to speak about players like that, but he was a real, real nice guy. But he's come to a foreign country, which wasn't easy for him. He must have thought he's hit the jackpot. Because honestly, he was...
And then that was the juxtaposition of that, though, right? That we've rallied. I think we paid 1.5 million for Fabbrini, didn't we?
Because
we hadn't spent any money. So that was like, wow, and it didn't work.
Yeah.
So the pressure was on. I think that was half the talk at the time, wasn't it? That if there is money coming in, will they trust Rowett with it?
Yeah.
Because of what he spent so far. Why not? He's only spent 1.5 million on.
Yeah. Diego was a good player. He just didn't work out for him.
No, but it's had that situation and then Rowett's gone and then Zola's there for a moment. He's gone. Harry comes in on a rescue package and
they're just kind of like, money that wasn't available
and
before.
I think obviously like Digger was obviously playing really well. He was a good player for obviously Blues. Had a good career here. And then Shea, obviously, there was links with him. He was on fire. And I think those two boys, they were given contracts just to keep them here, probably more than what they would normally pay otherwise.
Yeah.
And I think Digger signed a couple of contracts in a very short space of time. And obviously, good for him. He did well, you know. But players like him deserve the contracts. But we were bringing in other people who didn't probably deserve to be signing for us. Like some of the boys who come in, couldn't believe their luck how much money they were getting thrown at them because other teams wanted them. And then we were signing them. I think Jota was going up towards Middlesbrough and we offered him an extra 5-10 grand a week to get any turn around on the motorway to come back.
Well, Harley said, didn't they? That Harry said to him, anyone else you'd recommend?
Yeah.
And so Jota and
Maxim.
And Maxim Colin, was it?
Yeah, Maxim's a good player.
Yeah. Jota didn't work out for him. But
no, he's technically good. It just wasn't
technically.
Yeah, I don't think the club we suited is maybe, you know, the way he was, his style as a player. But yeah, it was a shit show. It was literally a shit show. When as soon as Rowett left, it was a shit show.
What does that do in the dressing room then? When all of a sudden people are coming in on these life changing sums to the original, to the nucleus that's already there?
It causes an unrest, really. But it was causing unrest anyway because when me and Clayton were signing different deals and we were like the top earners and blah blah blah, still players are still like, you know, they got one eye on you then, and there's cause a little bit of unrest because they then want to go in for a new deal and so on. So you do have that little bit of I wouldn't say jealousy, but they want what's best for their families as well, which you know is right. It's a short career, but when we're bringing in players that we used to target to play on when we were playing against them, and then we're bringing them in for more money than what,
yeah,
and they can't believe
it's got to be frustrating.
I'm not personally one for clickbait and
and
these kind of engagement, but you got to tell us at least one of them. Who are you targeting that then came in on massive money?
There was loads of them.
Everyone.
But we were like, I just couldn't. Yeah, well, it was strange. We were just I can, well, put it this way, we were looking to get promoted. We were looking, you know, we should be signing maybe players from on loan from a Premier League club, or you know, and we weren't. I just don't think. And it's quite strange how there was no money for Rowett to bring in those players. Then all of a sudden, what, you got a pot of money?
Well, that's why we was in the shit afterwards, wasn't it? Money that we didn't have.
Yeah. It's quite funny there. Like Redknapp, because we'd done an evening at Edgbaston, didn't we, when he first signed. I think there was a World Cup game, and he'd done like an introduction singing Keep Right On and all that. And it was brilliant to that, weren't it? You see him now, like I'm a celebrity
He plays the game very well.
Yeah, his persona of art.
That's a personality.
Just old Harry. I don't know what's going on. My dog's my accountant. But he's a very shrewd person.
He's a businessman.
Yeah. And having Redknapp come in as a player, I imagine galvanises you to think he's a legend, isn't he?
Yeah, he's a legend. He's had a great... Well, you can't knock him. He's managed for many, many years in the Premier League, hasn't he? Yeah. He's had a great career. But you have to, you know, you have to ask questions why he decided to come at like his age as well to Birmingham and such, because nobody's, you know, linked with Premier League jobs, isn't he? And maybe he was, I don't know, whether he should have had like maybe younger coaches around him if he brought him. But I remember we were doing like a drill out there and he was like, I just want you to do such and such, like tactical wise. And Stephen Gleeson said, oh, what do you want us to do? And you said, I don't know, just do it. So he didn't really have any tactical knowledge to pass on to you that you think,
just well, vibes.
You're a Premier League manager is a legend.
Yeah.
You know, give us some tactical knowledge. You've coached Bale, you've coached Modric, et cetera, et cetera. Or you've been a big club like Tottenham.
But it turns out that was just doing what I thought.
You have to sometimes question it. Was it the coaches who were doing the coaching? And he was just, you know, managing like those kind of like egos, which it happens because, you know, Roy Keane says a lot about Fergie. He was managing, you know, the players and he had coaches to do the rest. And, you know, of course, I'm not saying that's...
if it works, good,
but yeah, if it works, it works. But we just didn't have the coaches then to kind of like take us to that level that we should do. And it was a bit of a shit show. We had players who were brought in who probably... one as good as what we had there. Then there's players who got shipped out, you know, including myself, etc. You're then thinking, what's going on here? And it just causes a little bit of a, you know, divide in the dressing room. Not as that's we're arguing or anything, because we're all together, but just a little bit of like division where we don't know what's what. We don't know, because some players are playing the Rowett's way, then Zola's way, then Redknapp's way. And it's just like this, yeah, it's too much going on. Yeah.
Yeah.
Too much
confusion. As fans as well, we're just like, we're in the dark and we're already drip fed from the Evening Mail or from online or whatever. And we're just like, we're in disarray as well. The world, the world of football is taking the piss out of you.
Members of the board offering fans out on the car park.
It's crazy. It's just crazy. Because I've told this story a million times, but I was negotiating a new deal with Rowett and I wanted to stay. And we were going back and forth for like a few weeks because obviously I wanted the best money that I thought I deserved at that particular time.
Yeah.
Because as I say, it's a short career. You want to make the most and you want to, you know, be the best, et cetera. And we were negotiating a new deal. And then Zola came in. He's like, yeah, we want to keep you. We want to give you a new deal, blah, blah, blah. And then the last day of the transfer window, he said, you need to leave. If you don't leave, then your life is going to be made hell, I've been told to tell you. So
Zola said.
Yeah. And I knew that wasn't him because he's a nice guy.
Yeah, man.
He was definitely getting told above. Because Zola wasn't like that. He's a nice guy. Even if he's not, even if he's not playing you, you know that he's a nice human being. You know, you could just see it wasn't in his nature to be a dick like that.
And that's coming from the ball.
So I left, and I wasn't going to go. I was going to say no, I'm staying here. I'm not moving. And then Bristol City came in, and if it wasn't for Bristol City, I don't think I would have left, because Bristol City, I started my career off there and I knew the manager and he just said, look, we want a little bit of guidance. We want a little bit of experience. Yeah. Do you want to come here on loan? And I wanted a permanent deal at that point because here was a bit of a shit show. And I thought, I've been treated that way.
How would that have come back that time? Would your agent maybe have made the call and gone, look, is there anything going?
So no, at that stage, it was all done directly through me. Yeah. But the agents still get a fee. Don't worry about that. They're fucking, there's a few snaky ones out there. So they, I got the move. And then because Lee Johnson rung me directly and said, look, we've been in contact with Birmingham. You know, do you fancy coming on loan kind of thing? And I was adamant I wasn't going to go. And then I decided to go then because Zola just said, like, it's impossible for you to stay, really. You're going to be training on your own. And then when I came back from the preseason, where I told you I got married, hired Redknapp, didn't even speak to me for 4 or 5 days. I was made to train on my own with a fitness coach. And then after 4 days, I wanted to see him. I said, hi, Gaffer, can I have a word? He said, oh, David, I was just about to call you. And I said, mate, look, you made me train on my own for 4 or 5 days. I said, look, if I'm not going to train with you guys, at least have that respect to like speak to me like a human being to, you know, you're not for me kind of thing. And I started about 2 weeks later when we had like a cup game or something. Yeah. Strange, for straight into the starting line.
Where's your head?
I know. But I was betting he come in and it was like you say, it was a shit show. And he was like, he's decent, man. Yeah. What's he doing over there? Forgot about him a little bit.
Like, oh, I tried signing at you and I was like, Tottenham and Port. And I was like, yeah, right then. You didn't, there's levels to the game, you didn't. But like, yeah.
No, he's going too long with everyone. I tried signing at Tottenham.
He was just probably brought in here just like from the guys that he knows to give him a little
the players here, there and everywhere, like just go, all right,
well, let's try him a little bit. But like even when Steve Cottrell came in, I felt sorry for him because I would join Portsmouth on loan and he tried signing me a few times. I've known him for a few years and he was like putting players on a team sheet and he was getting told not to play certain players. He was so he was put in a difficult position as well. because he's a good manager, good man as well. And it was
he'd send the team straight upstairs, and
we put the team on. That's what he's thinking, because obviously the boardroom and then people above him were just pulling a bit of rank, you know. So yeah,
they were sitting on the training ground, but now they built an office on the training ground to oversee it all, and massive.
So, yes, yeah, it's mad times really, because the manager knows who's playing or who's training well. These guys have a clue. Really.
When did you know then that it's done?
When I came back from Bristol City, and I was like, I think I was hanging on for dear life, really. I was trying to work hard and giving my all for the club and trying to, like, you know, be here, but you just know your one foot's out the door because you're not wanted, really. You know, a few of the times I've ended up playing right back a few games, and
didn't do bad though.
Yeah, I did a right back. Yeah, I think because we had like a couple of injuries, and I went down, and then obviously Steve put me on, and I did all right. And then when you're hanging on for dear life, you just need that one bad game, and they're taking you back out. And as soon as that started happening, I just thought, nah, I need to go.
And how long did you have left on your contract then?
I had like another year or so, I think. Yeah, and
you need to start.
I came to an agreement with Steve, and he was just like, look, like, you know, like, the club don't want you basically above me, and you know
what, that makes like sense to think. So Cottrell took the brunt. I remember team selections.
Yeah.
Square pegs, round holes. It was all over the place, wasn't it?
Yeah.
But that wasn't even so.
That makes sense. But
he wouldn't have played those kind of really? Players. He you know, he likes hard working players who's got a bit about him and who we can trust. And I don't think there's too many players in there he could have trusted. He was great for me, really. He's the one who sorted me out the deal to get paid up, kind of thing. But I helped the club as well. I could have sat there and taken 100% of my wages, but I didn't. I probably should have, as a financial point of view, but I just wanted to keep playing football. And that's when I went to India then to play for a little bit. I hated it. Fucking hell.
How did that come about?
So one of Dean Saunders' fitness coach, I had a Doncaster, his mate was out there. Ashley Westwood, his name is, not the one who played for Villa. Who played for Villa, no, a different one. And and he was like director of football at some Indian club, and he said, look, come out here if you want to change the scenery, blah blah blah. So let's go out there. Robbie Keane was on the team, Ryan Taylor, who used to play for
Newcastle. I mean, there was a bit of a push for Indian football.
It's horrendous.
Yeah,
it was like you could have four or five foreign players, and the rest of the team were like local players. And it's no joke. It's like you just got them off the fucking street to play football. It was bizarre. Like Robbie Keane passing to someone and the ball would just run into their foot. And yeah.
Passing into the local butcher.
Yeah, looking some.
Was Johnson over there when he was over there? Roger Johnson?
No, he wasn't there when I was there.
But he did a similar thing and went over and he went, it's just.
Yeah, so Teddy Sheringham was my manager there.
That's it.
Yeah. Fucking hell.
What a bizarre set of circumstances.
Yeah, it's bizarre. So like Robbie Keane, Teddy Sheringham as a manager, and then you just will come out of the airport, there's a cow walking across the road with a leader. Obviously the culture shock is just so different. It's just like crazy.
Is it a bit of a busman's holiday as well, having an Indian but in India?
It was just like strange. Well, the local boys were having like curries and stuff before pre-match meal. I'm like thinking, oh, I want to have a bit of chicken and rice or like a poached egg on toast or something. Yeah,
I was gonna say, you get the nervous belly before.
Yeah,
you
got to run like the whole culture. It was just a massive culture shock. Yeah, it was mad. I couldn't wait to get
experience.
Home. I couldn't wait to go home.
So it's just a case of thanks, lads.
Yeah, thanks
but not for me. Yeah.
Yeah.
Just going back a little bit, Bale, Baller. Blows your mate,
best.
Bale, Ramsey, them kind of players. They're just a joke in training.
Yeah, but I'd say Ramsey's obviously an unbelievable player, but Bale's just that next level.
Got that aura.
For 2016, so he wasn't actually fit, was he? Is he not kind of playing game to game?
He was playing a little bit game to game. He was training now and again. He had his own like fitness coach and Spanish like guy who came over from Real Madrid to make sure
he carries clubs from on the golf course.
But he was he was training in and out. He was like obviously all patched up for games and stuff, but he was still he's unreal, unbelievable player.
Joke.
So when was it kind of dawning on you as a squad that you were going somewhere, that this was a real progression that you were making at the tournament?
It's quite strange because we yeah, we got there. We didn't have no expectation. We didn't have no tournament experience whatsoever. So, and even like the management staff as well, they were all new to all of us. So, but I think when we started to beat, I think we beat Russia, I think. I think after we beat them, I thought, we've got to be allowed. Like, yeah, we've got to be able to chance to go like quite far here. Because every team that we beat, Belgium as well.
Generation.
I know. And yeah, they were like, their squad was a joke.
Yeah.
And we popped them a little bit. But I just felt like we had the best player in the tournament. It was when you have that feeling of like you're going onto the pitch and we had the best player at the tournament. Even when we were playing against Portugal and Ronaldo was there, I still felt like our player was the better baller, you know?
Yeah.
And he was gassed up before the tournament and then he produced. It was
sometimes
you get gassed and you're like, oh, that's a bit of a damp squib in it. But he was
like an inevitable momentum with Wales as well, even as English. Like, it's like your second team.
Yeah.
And obviously, players will hate each other. Anyone, home nations, don't like each other. But you took everyone along with you, didn't you?
Yeah. It was class. It was an amazing experience. Nothing you'll ever experience in your life. Well, I will never, obviously, because I've retired. But
do you think they'll ever reach those heights again?
I hope so. But I think the thing is when you have someone like a Bale, he is just literally a generational talent, isn't he? And he might not come across... but around someone like that again for like another 40, 50 years for someone like a country like Wales, they're hard to come by. But in terms of, I think our whole squad as a whole, I think it's the best quality of Welsh squad we've had, because we even had most of the players on the bench were like top end championship, whereas like now it's like filtered out a little bit more. And we had like a lot of Prem boys in there as well. Our main core of our team were spot on really, and the spine of the team. They're doing really well now, and obviously unfortunate not to qualify, but I think where Welsh football is now to where it used to be, it's still in a great place.
No,
healthy guy, and
you see the expectations then? Yeah. Isn't it this genuine disappointment across the board? They didn't qualify.
Well, they qualified for the last few tournaments, so the expectations there, and obviously Bellamy's doing great.
Well, you spoke about Bellamy's professionalism. He feels like he's hungry as well.
He's very hungry, so it always helps having a manager like that. But unfortunately, he lost out on the most recent qualifier, but they've improved massively.
He's scared that he's too good for Wales and a Premiership team might come sniffing for him. I don't know.
Better me.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think so. I think everything that I hear about him, he's a top coach, and it's just his personality anyway. He's used to, he's one of the best. He's down for perfection. He was always a top professional, and he'll, make sure that his players are trying to act the same way.
He's definitely chilled out
a little bit more, what I've seen, because he didn't...
But you like that, though, don't you? You want that. You need a little bit of...
Yeah, I like that. That's what I loved about him. He's just got, like, that fiery determination, and that's why...
He was horrible, wasn't he?
Top player.
Yeah, for a forward as well.
Yeah, it's not...
He's horrible. Yeah, but he had the ability as well, didn't he?
Yeah, the ability. He was top player.
Yeah. It's just moving sideways slightly, away from the football. You've spoken openly about depression and gambling and... just life after football, really. And we spoke about it on the podcast before, having the adulation and then kind of going to those quiet moments. What made you decide to talk about it in a public forum?
It was alcohol. It was not the gambling side of things that was a problem for me. I was, so alcohol was mine. I think probably just the highs of being brought up in such like a young age, the pressures on you from a young age, and you don't, the ups and downs. I was going through a divorce, et cetera, et cetera. Then the system obviously uses that. You can't see your children, then you're fighting for your children. So to deal with all that, then playing football at a high level, if you have a bad game, you're getting slandered on social media, which is not as big as what it is now. It's worse now, obviously, from those platforms. But, I think fans and people, they have that perception of like footballers like robots. So because you're in that money, you don't have like normal human feelings. So, when you're going through a divorce, you're not seeing your children, then you're having like fans on your back that you're playing to a certain level. A lot of times I was going out I was just drinking nonstop, really, just to probably take that kind of feeling away. And so I was just drinking and just playing football. That's what I always used to do. I used to party a lot. I think hopefully now in this day and age, because I used to have teams who wanted to sign me, but they'd say to my agent, he's a good player, we want to sign him. And it probably cost me an absolute fortune to get better contracts and go to better clubs over the years. Because ability-wise, without sounding arrogant, I think I should have played most of my career in the Prem, I would have thought. Because when I used to go play, with Wales away, like Bale would say, you're the best free kick taker after me and stuff like that. So when you get a compliment like that where he's been, there's obviously something in it, So from that looking back, I think I drank way too much in terms of what I, and I was professional when I was coming to the gym and worked extremely hard, but I think that just took it away in the pressure. And I just started drinking a lot, you know, I was partying, girls and fucking drinking all the time, just to take away what you maybe feel like on a day-to-day basis.
Did that make you, so you've got a certain confidence about you, and did managers kind of get a bit of an arrogant fit? Did you feel like you, managers thought you were arrogant because you were drinking and your partying lifestyle, or did you think that, like you say, it's cost you a few contracts and stuff? Or is you kind of not doing it?
I didn't really hide it. No, there was a few times I come into Blues actually, and the physio would smell alcohol on me. He said, look, just stay in the physio room so you don't want to,
because everyone near smells on
you. Yeah, I know, fucking hell. So we were just like, yeah, so I had a few bevvies and come in, and then he could smell it on me. He's like, look, just stay in because you don't want to go out getting an injury and blah, blah. But I only ever drank one time on a Friday before a game, never drank the day before a game before, and I got caught in Birmingham. I was watching Justin Bieber, believe it or not, a concert, I think it was. And Troy Deeney's messaged me and said, oh, is that apple juice in your pint? There you go. And he's sending like laughing emojis because I'm sat with your manager and Rao was with him. And in my mind, I'm thinking, fuck it. You see me with one beer, I might as well just crack on now. So I ended up cracking on, I had a few more. And I started the next day. I think we won 4-2. I scored one and set up two. And he said, I want to see you in my office on Monday. He called me into his office on Monday. He said, look, I know you like to go out and blah, blah. That's what I like about your character. You're like, you know, you're fucking rough around the edges kind of thing. And that's what makes you. But don't let it affect your performances. And I don't want to see you drinking the night before a game. And that was it. He knew what I was about.
I thought he was going to say, he's like, oh, we'll feed you some before if you're going to play.
No, yeah, exactly. I know. But I think, well, he tried signing me at Derby as well. Tried to take me there. But I think those ultimate decisions of like bringing in a professional player and then do you bring in Kotz, who's kind of like, he's going to feel
like that. Tick, 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 tick. That's and the then, one thing
that's the kind of someone else. That was kind of constantly. But I'm hoping if that's the case with some of the players that play today, that the clubs are looking to help him.
Yeah.
Because who he used to be before was like, well, we're not signing him. He's a fucking problem. He loves a night out. Whereas like, well, why is he drinking? Can we help that player to be better? And then sometimes I think they just shift him to be someone else's problem rather than looking after them as a person, really.
It's a much bigger thing in football now, isn't it?
Yeah.
Or it's at least it's shown to be.
Yeah.
Whether there's anything behind it or not, I don't know. But
yeah. And the culture's changed slightly, hasn't it?
Yeah.
You said it was tailing off towards the end of yours, but predominantly the 2000s and the 2010, it was about, and the 90s obviously, was about going and enjoying it afterwards and getting on the beer, wasn't it?
It's just how you act like an arsehole when I was drinking. That was a problem. Towards the end, I was just a raving lunatic. I was just like going out and I was so unpredictable. I just wanted to drink all the time, and it would cause you, you know, take you into depression, and then you don't want to be around, and then you're not thinking straight because you've got that alcohol in your system, whereas obviously it's a depressant, whereas most people are so... Like even when I go to a restaurant now, they say, would you like a wine with that steak or whatever? And I'm like, no, thank you, blah, blah. And it's like looked on as, why are you not drinking? Whereas like if you offer them some drugs, then you say no, it's different. But you always have to like say why you're not drinking.
Yeah.
It's like fully abstinent. It's like, I've not drunk for 7 years. Yeah, but I've never done any drugs. But when I checked into rehab, they're like, oh, you're in here for cocaine and drink. And I was like, no, just drink. And they're like, well, most footballers, it goes hand in hand. I've never seen any of my teammates do any drugs ever. So I was like taken back by that myself. But the answer to your question why I become public knowledge is that when I was in rehab, I made a post on Instagram because I just thought there'd be another footballer out there who's feeling what I felt. And if I can just help one person, then hopefully I've done a little bit of my job, you know? And then I lost a lot of money in certain stuff. And the papers were on my shit then. The papers were trying to release newspaper articles on me as soon as I come out of rehab. My PR woman was like, there's no real reason why you should release this at this particular time because he's just come out of rehab, and the newspaper was like, we don't give a fuck. We're releasing them regardless, yeah. So I just come out of rehab, going through a divorce, not seeing my youngest daughter, missed my daughter's first birthday when I was in rehab, and then the newspapers are just like, yeah, they're ramping up a few notches, you know.
So your PR's even just said, can you leave it for now?
She managed to pull a couple of stories because when I first retired from football, this is how shit the stories go and whatever. This one football agent I worked for, he said, look, I'll give you X, Y, and Z to come on board. I'm trying to start this football agency up to be at a certain level. I managed to get a football player from the conference to Oxford because I knew the director of football at Oxford. So I got him to move from conference to League One. This agent was paying me in drips and drabs, not proper contract that we agreed. And then I never got that fee from the player signing, which agents fee you normally get. He never paid my wages. And then he tried selling the story to the newspapers by saying I'm a nightmare and hard to work for. And he sent me on an email saying we should use that to your advantage. We could ring the news, the Sun newspaper, make you a few quid and blah, blah, blah. I screenshot that email, sent it to my PR woman, and because the Sun were going to release another paper article on me, and that's when they pulled the plug because he was trying to make money off me to then...
So you had to like counter...
Yeah, I had to counter attack that way. Otherwise, it'd been another story. Yeah. There's a few of those going on. Yeah. Trying to kick a guy when he's down, you know?
That's horrible.
It happens.
That's horrible.
It happens when you're probably
selling newspapers.
Yeah. Well, yeah, especially when I got him a player, the player move. Yeah. Like, I understand that not everyone's going to like me, and that's absolutely fine. I'm not saying I'm sitting here and saying I'm perfect. I've made lots of mistakes. But
that's what you find, though. That's been an underlying story. Yeah. There's a lot of people in football who are just, not just in football, but in PR and
tabloid, horrible.
Mm. It was like I was getting a message like every other day saying another newspaper's coming out about you and blah, blah, blah. It was just constant, yeah. And then it then manifested into, you know, some of the stuff that I speak about mental health or speak about addiction or speak about conspiracy stuff that I was speaking about or vaccinations or whatever, or like how kids are being, you know, since vaccinations, there's a lot more of autism going around, et cetera, which is facts. And, the Daily Mail wouldn't leave me alone. They're just writing stuff on me constantly. Yeah.
The Daily Mail.
Oh, yeah.
Foreign British just institution.
Touching upon that then. So social media for how horrific it is. It is quite funny.
Yeah.
So you have been quite vocal, same as Matt Letizia,
yeah,
who has similar beliefs and obviously everyone's entitled to beliefs and certain things have been proved, certain things haven't been proved. What kind of stuff do you get on social media? And I know a lot of them say about your tin hat and we've seen we put some out to say, David Koch was coming on and someone put, ask me if the chemtrails have made me trans or something. Something out there that I think you get kind of, what's the word I'm trying to say? You get kind of put in this category that everything you speak about on a conspiracy is lunacy.
We had, there's no context to a lot of things these days, and obviously like you say with tabloids and stuff like that, they'll pick something and run with it because it looks good or it looks out there. So what is your relationship with social media?
Well, even when I spoke about the Epstein list not so long ago, when I used to speak about that years and years ago, about, you know, the elite people or, you know, celebrities, if you like, a trafficking children or sexually abusing children. I've spoken about this years and years ago. I used to get, like, they sold stories on me, or not sold stories, but they put stories on me of being me mentally unwell, talking about this stuff. And even if I post something like that on Twitter, someone says, calls me a fucking idiot. And I'm like thinking, well, how are you an idiot if you're calling out people who are hurting children? I don't get it. I don't get the logic. But going back to the conspiracy stuff, I think it must be about 67 conspiracies that are right compared to the other ones, like the chemtrails that in the actual UK government website are being, you know, they're in there where they're seeding that, like they're seeding the clouds. Oh, like,
before the conspiracies around that, there was no talk of the cloud seeding. No, but now
it's accepted.
Oh yeah, we do cloud.
Like they're openly saying that. And then even like Dubai, they spend like $20 million a year to manipulate the weather. So when I used to speak about this stuff, it's actually factually out there in the public domain. So many people are lazy. They just don't even look at it. But, you know, it's a fact. They want us ill. Like that's, I believe that I said this to my mum actually the other day. She's like, we're talking about the pharmaceutical companies. If people were so healthy and well, they would make no money. They're a $1 trillion business or £1 trillion business, you know?
Yeah.
It's like the same things. If people weren't in debt, there'd be no banks. You know, if people were in debt, the banks are going to keep running. So that's just like, it's just logic. So healthy people don't make these companies money, unfortunately, but people don't see it that way.
Do you find, because these conversations go on every day on social media, and different people will kind of form groups and communities where
there's people who will comment on this going, but you're going to get that, aren't you? It's not just an isolated, go on, carry on, I'm disturbed, but it's not just an isolated one person saying it here and there, is it?
No, I've lost my train of thought now.
Sorry. but yeah, a lot of people are saying it, but it's still kind of kept under. Whereas like
Oh, it's, yeah. If you weren't in the public domain, if you weren't the figure that you are, there wouldn't be so much focus on it, would there?
Yeah. It's just like hard, you know, Matt Letizia, who I know, he's a great guy, and everything he speaks, I think, is facts. I support everything that he says, you know. I've got the same kind of thought process that he thinks. And I just find it crazy that, you know, why would anyone want children to get hurt and trafficked all over the world? It's a massive business for these people, and they're doing it on a regular basis. That celebrities that are worshipped by everyone, but because they're their favorite celebrity, they don't want to have a bad word said about him, you know.
Mm. It speaks volumes that they can't release the files completely, doesn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
That names have got to be redacted, etc. But
I just find, me, myself personally, I feel like if I just go too much into it, this is me just being deep, that my head would just go and I'll be done.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
So I see everything now as being mainly fake. Like when I see things, I've gone into so many rabbit holes. It's like little things, like the amount of times you see the number 33, which is obviously massive for like the Freemasonry and like the symbolism. If you see a lot of like things that happen in the world, like 33 is not too far away from like this stuff. And I'm like, it just blows your mind. But
yeah,
some people think I'm fucking nuts, but
I'm half scared of it.
It is what it is. I'm half scared of it. Yeah, the main thing that I went into this when I was playing my career, I was a thing called Pizzagate, which is basically the trafficking of children. So that was my main thing. And then, you know, a couple of people I'd speak to about, they saw, well, I've gone down this rabbit hole. You checked this out. Before you know it, you've gone down like all these different things of like what's going on. But anyone who speaks up against children being trafficked, I don't think it's a bad thing. It's only a good thing, you know, because it's happening right under, you know, our nose.
That's too many coincidences, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, the thing is, since kind of from COVID and the PPE funding and the people who got money that are friends of the politicians, the internet now, it's too smart, isn't it? So the things that governments could get away with before and you'd not hear anything about, well, you'd probably find if you went back, if you had the internet during the Iraq war, the weapons of mass destruction, things like came out, didn't it? There was none. But now, with the internet being as it is, it's playing out in real time.
Some of the independent people and outlets and stuff as well.
Yeah, but AI, you don't know what's wrong.
Well, that's the next thing. That's the next thing.
So it's a bit crazy. But now, I don't really speak too much about the conspiracy stuff now. I know what's right and I know what's wrong. I've done enough education over the years to see what I'm doing. I don't really get involved, and I just keep myself to myself. I had my old Instagram taken down as well, because I was speaking up on these things. So when I used to speak about, you know, COVID stuff, I had like literally 2 views on my stories compared to all the thousands of followers I had. And it's only recently I just got a new Instagram, maybe about 8-9 months ago, and I'm back to the drawing board. But all I do is play paddle and post that, really.
Yeah, so. I've seen your paddle on Instagram. Yeah, it's still in decent shape. I think I see a decent nick as well.
Yeah, trying.
What's life look like now after football?
I just chill, really. I try and I go to the gym.
I've seen your Instagram with your tats and naps on the beach looking all
honestly.
I covered iron.
Yeah, just my bum cheeks are covered.
Yeah,
that's covered job. But I was thinking about it, but yeah, I'm gonna take it easy now. It's like my tats, I think I'm covered enough. But
how's your paddle game coming on?
It's getting there. It's obviously always, you know,
next champion.
Because of my addictive personality, I want to get real good. I'm going to probably get lessons. I play with a lot of my mates back in Cardiff, and I went to Sheffield recently and played with like the Sheffield United boys. They had a good tournament up there, and yeah, it was good. It was just, it's great fun, you know. It's addictive as hell. Like, you obviously, when I finish football, I think this is the first thing I've real competitive. So I love it. Go to the gym, walk my dog, spend time with my kids, my family, and that's it, really. Yeah,
that was wicked. Let's do some quickfire before we let you go. Do you want to start?
Yeah. Best stadium you've played in?
For my personal view, Old Trafford, I would say, because I'm a Man United fan. So when I played there for Wigan in the Prem, I think that would be my favourite stadium.
Class.
Yeah.
Did your international career overlap the gigs?
So when I made my debut for Wales, I took his record like by 10 days as the youngest ever player, and I come on for him. Yeah, so I played with Giggs and played with Bale, probably two of the arguably the best Welsh players, really.
Keep that up.
Clip with the best left wingers Premier League history, I'd say.
Yeah, ridiculous.
Coming from a left winger, well, but I can see him.
Giggs was always my hero growing up, because that's why I wanted to wore the number 11 shirt for Birmingham and all the other teams. They were always my thing. And then obviously managed to play with someone like Bale is unreal, really. Yeah,
that's class. Favorite goal
that I've scored,
yeah,
I would probably say...
It's a tough one.
You've scored some absolute shit pingers, haven't you?
Yeah, I've got a few. My favourite goal. I like my one for Bristol City when I was 16 or 17 when I ran through the Huddersfield defence and scored. I've never been able to get hold of that goal ever since. I can't see it. That's why fucking shipping this old. Can't get the clips on.
Some grimy old
black. I'd say probably the halfway line goal for Doncaster, which was against Walsall, I think. That was probably up there. Yeah.
Got that one, definitely.
Yeah.
One game you'd love to play again?
Probably the Sheffield United playoff final against Burnley. We lost 1-0. I think I was young as well, and the game just absolutely flew by. We went 1-0 down. It was like the time was just eating up, and we just couldn't get momentum. We couldn't get back in the game. Burnley were the better team on the day, and that was a chance to get promoted to the Prem. So I think if I could play another game, it'd be that.
Like it.
And finally, would you have a message for Blues fans for your time here? I know you didn't really get to say goodbye properly.
Do you know what? I get a lot of stick off some Blues fans, you know, believe it or not. Because all the conspiracy stuff, they think I'm fucking raving lunatic. But I think when I was here, I felt the love, I think. They gave me a lot of support. But
you were classed down here at the
time. Yeah, I love
it. Considering the madness at the time, you were one of the shining bright, you and like, Clayton.
When you get that stick, because I don't think the fans really knew of what was going on behind the scenes, but I never wanted to leave. The biggest compliment I could say, I wanted to finish my career here. I didn't want to play for another team. So I always felt like, you know, we had a lot of, you know, support from the fans on me, because we were like, it's like we took a few steps back and then we grew together again.
When I was watching your goal compilation, when I was doing the research and that, the amount of half empty fucking sections of the stadium, you know, you're celebrating and you're going to fucking do the salute to the one guy in the block, you know, we deserve so much more. And to be at the club at the time you were at, where it was so up and down and so unpredictable, and it just, you're in a bit of a lull, weren't it?
Yeah. And it was class here, though. Do you know the evening games and the crowd were up? I used to love the nighttime games on a Tuesday or Wednesday night. Floodlights on and you're just like, fuck it, and you're winning as well.
And look, at the time as well, as a fan, it was us against them.
Yeah. That's what
we don't
like,
care about Carson. It was like, what are they doing to the club? We might as well club together. And a lot of the results were ground out of that. It felt like it was us against them.
It was like the players and the fans together. Yeah.
But
it was class. The fans were great. Like, I love my time here. If I could have signed another contract to stay here, and the best that I wish Rowett didn't leave, to be honest. I think we were onto something good. All the players were class. We had a wicked change room. There was no fucking egos or animosity going on. We just had like a hard group of players who worked hard. We had good youth players come through, obviously Damari coming through and a couple of others. So yeah, it was good. It was just a good time to be here. And then
I think that's our butterfly effect moment, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, Rowett going, I know whatever was going on behind the scenes, whether he's, you know, there was the release, the rumours, didn't they? He was talking to other clubs and flirting with Norwich and whoever else at the time, but which you'd be perfectly entitled to speak to people considering the state the club were in. But was the moment, wasn't it, where the club just kind of went...
Yeah, he just didn't get the back in, and then but hopefully, you know.
But then again, butterfly effect. We wouldn't be here today, and the ground's changed so much. Yeah. So the American owners may not, the Knighthead might not get involved.
Yeah, so it's good things. So stadium about Chris Davis, and he was the analyst actually when I was at Swansea City.
I was going to say So under Rodgers was
Davis there. He took him to Celtic and took him as his right hand man. But he was always, you know, a student of the game and used to work really hard. And it's good that he's getting his opportunity, you know.
Class. Thanks for coming on.
No worries. Thanks for having me.
Legend.
Brilliant.
Cheers, man.
If you like this video, please do click to subscribe to the channel. We currently have 5,500 members, over 500,000 views. So let's convert some views into memberships, and that will continue to enable us to bring great guests on and continue making great podcasts. Thanks.